Welcome to Oncology Nursing Update, optimizing the upfront management of individuals with newly diagnosed multiple myeloma, part one. I'm medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love, and I'm joined today by Dr. Xavier Leloup from the Poitiers University Hospital in Poitiers, France, to discuss nursing considerations for patients with newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes, and we will be talking about the use of agents and treatments that are not approved, so check out the package insert for more information. To begin, I asked Dr. Leloup to give a historical perspective of how myeloma was treated in the past. I want to start out by asking you if you could talk a little bit about how myeloma was treated up front, a newly diagnosed patient, let's say 2005, 2010, around the time RVD was coming in, and how patients did 15, 20 years ago, and now today, how they're treated and how they do their prognosis. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So what we need to understand here is that why is lenalidomide, the first of the immunomodulatory drug, that's the name of the family, was developed and was bortezomib, the first of protease inhibitors was developed, and then why did the combination develop? So you need to understand where you come from. So first of all, for everyone in the call here or the audience that were listening to the this discussion, we came from a world of alkylating agents, named melphalanprednisone in most of the country in the woods, and in some country, more like UK and UK-affiliated countries, Commonwealth, they didn't like melphalan much, they like cyclophosphamide. Why did we like melphalan and cyclophosphamide? Because it was an oral drug. It was easy to give. There was only two drugs, melphalan plus dexamethasone, but it has a lot of side effect. It was very active, but it had a lot of side effect. And you could not give it for long, because if you give melphalan and cyclophosphamide for very long, initially you have a great effect on myeloma. The safety profile initially is not bad, but the more you give it, the more the safety profile is a problem. So it was really nonsense to go towards a disease you cannot cure, that is going to be chronic, with a drug that you cannot give on a chronic way. It's like you treat hypertension, you give an hypertension drug, it works, but you have to stop it. It makes no sense because you know hypertensions will get back. So we had to improve this. And we were lucky in myeloma in the early 2004 for lenalidomide and bortezomib that almost were discovered almost at the same time, because at least with lenalidomide, we had an oral drug that seemed to be safe enough, and yet you could give on the long run, more than 6 months, more than a year long. Point number one. Point number two, lenalidomide is a great drug, but we very rapidly understood that as a single agent, it was not strong enough against myeloma. If you compare melphalan, cyclophosphamide, single agent or plus dexamethasone compared to lenalidomide and dexamethasone, melphalan and cyclophosphamide initially was greater, better, more active. But on the long run, lenalidomide did better. So initially, we combined, actually, before bortezomib and lenalidomide dexamethasone triplet-based combination, we historically combined melphalanprednisone plus thalidomide, the first drug that was let's say the grandfather of the lenalidomide and pomalidomide, the IMIDs. So we first combined them to melphalan in France, in the US, and in many countries in the world, to cyclophosphamide in UK and in Commonwealth based affiliated countries. And it was very active, and we were very happy. Melphalanprednisone thalidomide was compared to a lot of previous existing standard of care, and it was active. It was safe enough. But again, problem, you cannot give melphalanprednisone for long. So at some point, we understood that three drugs in myeloma was better than two, two better than one. But melphalan and cyclophosphamide were not the best combinatory drug to lenalidomide. And here came bortezomib, a different proteasome inhibitor, a different family, different mechanism of actions as lenalidomide and melphalan. Actually, very interesting for the people that listening to this call, you have to understand that in early 2000, we were getting rid of chemo, the chemotherapy, the old way of thinking. You kill the tumor and you create a lot of side effects. Doesn't matter, you kill the tumor. And we were getting rid of that. And we wanted to think about the tumor as a dysfunctioning system. And by a little tricky thing, you could make it disrupt. And it's really what the proteasome inhibitors were about. And I'd like to remind everyone a little bit of history here. That I don't know, Neil, if you know that story, actually. One of the guys who created the proteasome inhibitors, he visited Marseille, the city of Marseille in France. And when he visited with his wife Marseille, there was a strike. And because of the strike in these people who get rid of the trash, he discovered that an entire city could be entirely paralyzed just because you don't get rid of the trash. And
wow, what a story.
Yeah, and the guy was doing study in the US, and he was trying to understand the tumor cells, because they proliferate a lot, they need to recycle a lot. And what if you could stop the recycling? What if you could forbid the cells, the tumor cells, from using the trash? Could they be paralyzed? And he came up developing the proteasome inhibitors because he understood that the proteasome was a trash of the cell. And so if you wow. inhibit the capture of the collection of the trash, then the tumor cells would die. And this is initially how, I don't know if that story is entirely true, but the guy promised me that there was how he initially thought about this proteasome inhibitor, bortezomib drug, as a way to give a targeted treatment, and that would block a very sensitive organ that the tumor cells need to proliferate. And so we developed bortezomib combinations, we developed lenalidomide combinations, and at some point, we figured out that maybe the combination of the two could do miracle, and the combination of the two had a miracle effect, because you had a triplet-based regimen. Because with the bortezomib, you had a short treatment, but very targeted, with a very specific effect to the tumor cells. And with lenalidomide, you could give a prolonged treatment. So in the end 2010 years, so from 2000 to 2010, we kind of understood what could be the best treatment to treat myeloma, getting rid of alkylating agents, giving prolonged treatment, and having a targeted therapy effect, very specific on the tumor cells. Now, while we understood how effective were these treatments, while we understood what we have brought to the disease, in the end 2010, we also understood the limitations of that triplet-based combinations. Dexamethasone was toxic at some point. Bortezomib was at some point toxic. And again, lenalidomide could be given for much longer than bortezomib and dexamethasone, but there was also some safety profile in the long run. And so we had to develop new mechanism of actions, new family of drugs. And in myeloma, we still never had developed, commercialized an immunotherapy. In lymphoma, rituximab, the first CD20 antibody, monoclonal antibody immunotherapy for therapeutic use, was already developed 10 years ago. But in myeloma, we still had no immunotherapy. So we understood that we had to move on with the bortezomib index, and we had to find something new. And here came this new gigantic family mechanism action treatment, immunotherapy based, that certainly we're going to talk about in a minute. That was a way to answer some of the limitation we had experienced with bortezomib index.
So I think you're talking about anti-CD38 monoclonal antibodies. Can you talk about what we've learned about that?
Exactly. You're absolutely right. So we in myeloma, we had a lot of immunotherapy development between 2000 and 2010, but all of them failed. All of them failed because myeloma is not lymphoma. In myeloma, myeloma is a disease of the bone marrow. So you have an intrinsic malfunctioning of the immune system. So if you use an immunotherapy, the principle of mechanism of action, how an immunotherapy works, is through the immune system. And immunotherapy is nothing than a bridge between the tumor cells and the immune system. But a bridge, you need an, a start, you need an end. And you need the start and the end to work, or you're never going to cross the river. And so the immune system must be working if you want to get onto the bridge. And if you want the immune system to get one side of the monoclonal antibody that on the other side captures the tumor cells. And we rapidly understood that regular basic antibody in myeloma, such as rituximab in lymphoma, in B-cell lymphoma, were not working. And this company in Denmark found out this specific antibody and the fact that CD38 was a great target in myeloma. It was highly expressed on plasma cells. It was actually highly expressed on many other cells, but it did not have much consequence if there was an off-tumor effect target. So if you CD38, for example, is expressed on red blood cells, but when CD38 is targeted on red blood cells, the red blood cells, they have a system to protect from hemolysis. And so CD38 was a great target because it was highly expressed on plasma cells. And when it was expressed on non-tumor cells, but there were no much consequence on those non-tumor cells. So the risk of side effects was very limited. And when we understood that targeting CD38 on tumor cells was great because tumor cells need CD38. And so if you target CD38, it's not only a port, a harbor to dock on. It's also something that's going to disrupt the physiopathology of the tumor cells. So it became very interesting immunotherapy. And the good thing with immunotherapy is that you can combine immunotherapy to any drug. And we discovered that you can combine immunotherapy to dexamethasone, corticoids. You can combine immunotherapy to lenalidomide. It was actually highly synergistic. So 1+1 is not equal 2 here. 1+1 is equal 10. So this combination was extremely effective. We also discovered, actually, that CD38 monoclonal antibody, that immunotherapy, could be combined to proteasome inhibitors like bortezomib. Not as good as lenalidomide, but could be very attractive and as an initial treatment, for example. So very rapidly, in the early 2010 to 2015, the first of the immunotherapy CD38 targeting, daratumumab, and then rapidly after other came in, became a standard of care because it was convenient. It was initially IV, but rapidly the pharma company were able to switch it to subcutaneous manual push formulation, so make it even more practical for nurses in the outpatient clinic departments, but also for the patients in terms of safety profile. So the second most crazy, miraculous, I would say, development in myeloma truly was about the development of all this combination that surrounded the CD38 monoclonal antibody as the backbone.
So that kind of brings us up to where we are today, where anti-CD38 therapy is included in, it seems like, most patients who are initially diagnosed with myeloma, now even maybe smoldering disease, and we can talk about that as well. Can you talk about right now what the typical approach is to a younger patient, you know, 60, 70 years old, who theoretically would be eligible for an autologous transplant as consolidation, and also how you generally approach older patients, 75, 80, who are not maybe eligible for a transplant?
So let's start with the transplant eligible. In the 1990 to, I would say, 2010 years, the principle was transplant. What was given before, what was given after, was not much important. We thought that the most of the job was done by the transplant. But transplant is toxic. It's very tough for the patients. It creates sterility. It creates menopausis. It creates initial lot of side effects, risk of infection. Many patients takes months to recover. Most of the patients are recovered from the most greatest side effects that arise very early on, mucitis, loss of hairs, infection, etc. But beyond 2 to 3 months, when all these side effects have recovered, there are other side effects that the patient may experience. So when we had no real non-transplant-based drugs to develop in myeloma, transplant was most of the effect we were getting from the treatment. But when we developed the lenalidomide, the bortezomib, and then after the CD30 antibody, we understood that if we wanted one day to get rid of transplant in myeloma, we had to improve before and after the transplant. And we had to make induction, transplant, and post-transplant consolidation maintenance phases. We had to make the phases before and after the more and more efficacious, so transplant would at some point become useless or not as important as it used to be. So that's why we develop bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, then CD38 monoclonal antibody plus bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone containing 3 drugs, 4 drugs based regimen, initially before transplant, because it was the most obvious move to dig bulk, reduce the treatment before transplant. So number one, transplant will work on a residual disease, much more active, but also the need for transplant to debulk, much less needed because it has been done with the induction prior to transplant. So that's how we started. And then we understood that myeloma becoming more and more a chronic disease because more and more patients were having a very prolonged survival. We needed a treatment post-transplant to continue controlling the disease and reinforcing the immune system to control the remaining tumor mass in the patient because it's a chronic disease and we still don't know how to cure myeloma. So that's how the concept of a treatment before and treatment after developed. And then we went step by step. We had lenalidomide, so we tested lenalidomide. We had bortezomib, we tested bortezomib. And then we tested the 3 drugs together, bortezomib and dex. But then the problem was still that a lot of patients had side effects. If you give 6 months of treatment prior to transplant, autologous transplantation, with bortezomib, many patients will still have some side effects developing. And so if we want to improve that, we had to discover drugs, new mechanisms of actions and drugs that would be safe. And when the CD38 monoclonal antibody were developed, we immediately appreciated how safe they were. And that makes sense because they are immunotherapy based, they are no targeted, and they are no alkylating based drugs. So we very rapidly included the CD30 antibody into the bortezomib and lenalidomide dexamethasone regimen. That became a 4-drug-based regimen. If you think about it with the mind of a scientist, a researcher, a PhD doctor, lenalidomide is like salt and pepper in your dinner. If you eat a dinner without salt and pepper, it tastes less. You don't eat. Daratumumab or isatuximab, the 2 CD30 antibody, is like the meat. You still need vegetables. That's exactly what bortezomib is about. And you need a plate, fork, and knife. That's exactly what dexamethasone is about. And so if you think about it, the 4 drugs have 4 different mechanisms of action. So if you put them all together, you tackle the tumor cells 4 different ways. It had to be effective. Of course, now, years after, it's obvious. But when we started, it was, technically speaking, a winning move because the 4 drugs had 4 different mechanisms of action and the safety profile was manageable because the drug you added, the immunotherapy, we knew was almost ultra safe and was really like no side effects adding. So that's why we very easily developed this induction 4 or 6 cycles, 4 or 6 months, 28 days based prior to the transplant. Later on, we have been trying to apply what we had in the induction, the 4 drugs that seemed to be safe enough, post-transplant. We discovered that the same regimen was not that easy to give post-transplant because the patient had been transplanted and they would be slightly more fragile, even though they are very young. And so we thought about something lighter post-transplant. So we gave limited amount of these 4 drug or 3 drugs based regimen post-transplant. Actually, in the US, you guys never liked it much. And you very rapidly, you dropped this concept of consolidation. And you went immediately for 1 drug maintenance, the lenalidomide, the safest of them out of all these drugs.
So I wrote down a bunch of questions I want to ask you. First of all, I love these metaphors. The garbage strike thing was incredible. I never heard that story before. Of course, I've heard about the garbage analogy, but the strike thing was really interesting. And I love the way you set up the dinner table there with the meat and the utensils. Great metaphors. I'll tell you a quick story kind of related to this, which sort of leads to the next question I have, which is, what has this meant for patients and their survival? We did a program a couple weeks ago where we actually had patients that I interviewed with relapsed myeloma. We were doing a webinar for patients. And so I was asking these patients in these recording sessions, what do you want me to ask the doctors and what was the experience like? And one of the patients brought up an interesting idea, and I don't know whether they do this in France, but she said, you know, when you're a patient with myeloma and you go into the oncology office, you see all this activity around patients having a bell rung in the clinic. I don't know if you do that in France, but like when people get adjuvant chemotherapy for breast cancer and then they're finished, they have this bell in the infusion room and they ring the bell and everybody celebrates that the patient's finished adjuvant therapy. And then this patient said, well, they never ring the bell for us. So I wanted to ask you what this actually meant to patients, because actually from my point of view, what I said in the conference was, I really think there should be a bell for myeloma. And you ought to ring that bell when you end up dying of something else and you really never had a problem like you had chronic myeloid leukemia. And I brought up the analogy of CML and being able to maybe not cure the disease but have patients live close to a normal life expectancy of die of something else. And I guess my question is, when you think back to those initial RVD days, in particular 2010, et cetera, what were you saying to patients about how long they could expect to go without having to get another therapy? And what do you say to them today?
So it's absolutely a great point. And I like the bell run thing. The metaphor, I like it very much. So we don't bell the run in myeloma. And we're not, to be honest with you, today we don't bell the run either. We have different drugs, but we still can't bell the run. It's not ready for prime time in myeloma. I'm going to say something, and in a minute, I'm going to say the opposite. But what I want to say here is that I'm firmly convinced that we haven't yet found in myeloma the treatment that would allow the patient to live a normal life without any treatment similar to the CML, chronic myeloid leukemia, example you picked. Not yet in myeloma, because the patients must understand one thing. I started myeloma in 1998 as an intern. In 1998, the survival of the patient was no better than 3 years. Today, I can say to a patient, let Belgium run with one notion, which is you're not going to die from myeloma. Many patients today, I want to say, I would say most of the patients today are not going to die from myeloma. Let's Belgium run on that notion. The next level is let's do the same prolongation of survival. You're not going to die from myeloma. But now you're not going to die from myeloma and you're going to be without treatment for years. That level, we're not there yet. Because it took us 20 years to be able to run the bell saying, guys, you're not going to die of myeloma. Your survival is secured, but not the survival without treatment. This is something we are working on now. So you'll get the answer in 10 years. Because the problem is that it takes 10 to 20 years to completely change something. It's not that quick. I mean, it doesn't take 1 year. It's not because you find a genius drug that in 1 year you know how to use it the best way and you can save most of the patients with myeloma. Remember, myeloma is multiple. We call it multiple myeloma. Now we keep the multiple in the terminology, multiple myeloma, because there are various profiles of myeloma. Some of them are very easy to treat, but some of them are difficult to treat. So I think we can promise the patient, most of them, even the difficult to treat, might not die of myeloma today in 20 years' time. I think we can say that, but we cannot say we found the best drug, the drug that could take us there without any treatment. Now, once I've said that, and that's why I'm saying, I'm going to say now exactly the opposite to what I've just said. Once I've said that, there are two new immunotherapy
technology drugs that we have developed recently, the CAR-T cells and the bispecific, maybe you and I will reconvene in 10 years. And maybe in 10 years, you tell me the same story over the bed run, and I'm telling we are there now. We now can say to a patient with myeloma, you get 3 years of bispecific, one shot of CAR-T, and you will never relapse, bell the run. Maybe, but I don't know yet, because CAR-T were developed 5 years ago, bispecific 3 years ago, and I don't know. I don't have enough follow-up to be able to tell to the patients, you can bell the run, it's easy.
So, I mean, your CAR-T and bispecifics right now are usually used in people who relapse. But right now, when we just did a survey, we asked some investigators, what do you say to a patient, standard risk myeloma, like most patients, who gets this quad therapy, anti-CD38 plus bortezomib and lenalidomide and dexamethasone? What do you say to them about how long it will be before they will need a new therapy? In other words, their progression-free survival. And we had people estimating 7 to 10 years. Do you agree with that?
I disagree. I think if you look at the most recent study called Perseus, that probably the patients know better now, in Perseus, the median EFS, death or progression of myeloma for the patients is expected to land between 12 and 15 years. This is much better than 7 and 10 years. So if you give isatuximab, bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, 6 cycles, a transplant, and some lenalidomide or daratumumab lenalidomide or something post-transplant, possibly a treatment forever, I agree. This is not what the patient wants. But if you give it this way, you can say to a patient, the likelihood to hit the relapse or potentially death, but more likely the relapse, is going to be between 10 and 15 years and probably 12 to 15 years. So it's not 7 and 10 anymore.
So, that's a great point. So I want to drill down a little bit on some of the details here. And one of the things that occurred on this story that you told about the evolution of treatment and anti-CD38, and you just mentioned isatuximab, but there are two anti-CD38 antibodies that now have been very well developed, isatuximab as well as daratumumab. Can you talk about a little bit about how they proceeded? You know, they had different sort of research paths. And one of the things that was very interesting, as you mentioned, I guess initially these drugs were given intravenously. I think daratumumab came out first, and initially they were like very, very long infusions, a lot of infusion reaction. And then, as you mentioned, daratumumab, they came out with a sub-Q formulation. Isatuximab just recently came out with a sub-Q on-body device that you actually have a lot of experience with, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today, because there are very few people actually who've actually used this on-body device that's very relevant to nurses. But can you talk a little bit about how that sort of played out, and where do you think things are going to head in the future in terms of choice of anti-CD38?
Well, so there are lots of things here. So number one, isatuximab versus daratumumab, basic. Not considering here the formulation IV versus sub-Q, but just the two immunotherapy. They target the same CD38. The CD38, we call it the epitope, recognized on the tumor cell is different. But in the end, this is CD38. So the mechanism of action of the isatuximab and daratumumab are the same. However, the intensity for one mechanism versus the other one is different. For example, what we call the complement-dependent activity is stronger with daratumumab. But isatuximab has it, but it's stronger with daratumumab compared to isatuximab. On the other hand, the what we call the ADCC, antibody-depending cytotoxicity, is stronger with isatuximab, but daratumumab has it. But it's much stronger with isatuximab. And the fact that when the monoclonal antibody captures the CD38, it creates death, apoptotic, we call it apoptosis, but death of the tumor cells, is stronger with isatuximab compared to daratumumab. So clearly, the two immunotherapy are different. Now, in the end, honestly, in clinic, we don't see much a difference at a patient level. One of the reasons is that we don't use the drugs single agent, but we use them in combination. So to get back to my dinner thing, compare example, you can use one salt or another type of salt, but probably in the end, in your dinner, it's going to taste like salt. You're going to have a hard time. So the cook knows it was one or the other salt, but you, on your table, when you eat your dinner, tastes like salt, doesn't taste like one versus the other. And honestly, this is what we see in practice, is that the drugs are different, but clinically, we don't see much of a difference. So this is high-level thing. Now, once we said that, it's, as you pointed out very rightly here, the drugs were developed IV, because you always develop a drug IV initially. It's easier to develop a drug when it's IV, because you can, once you inject the drug in the venous, in the vein of the patient, in the serum, what you get is immediately the serum concentration, and you can immediately appreciate the serum concentration and the activity and the safety profile. It's so easy to develop this way. But of course, for the people who treat patients, for the nurse, for the patients, IV is a pain. Because you have to put, for many patients, we have to put on portable chambers, stuff like that. It's really not convenient. So, of course, when you know how your drug works, what the concentration you can give to a patient, and how you better treat the disease, then you can start developing a better way, formulation of giving the patients, and that's a sub-Q. For some drugs, you give it oral, but for immunotherapy, it cannot be oral. It has to be given either subcutaneously formulation or IV formulation, because the compound would get destroyed in the tract, in the GI tract of the patients before it could get into the serum and show any activity. So immunotherapy cannot be developed as oral drug, so they had to be developed as subcutaneous formulation, and the company who developed daratumumab was the first one to find a way to give the daratumumab subcutulation. So subcutaneous is not that easy to develop, because when you inject a big volume subcutaneously, you first have to have an enzyme who separate the cells of your interstitial tissue, so the immunotherapy bulk could develop in and not create a hole in your belly. And so, because then you would have sequelae, scars, and potential infections. So the daratumumab was the first to be developed with a special enzyme called hyaluronidase acid. And it was the first to be able to demonstrate that you could inject CD38 antibody immunotherapy subcutaneous formulation, different than what the lymphoma did with rituximab, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it was the introduction to the fact that we could now simplify the life of the patient. Daratumumab will be given to all patients with myeloma, one way or the other, at one time, one other time, but the simplest way, which was subcutaneous. Now, when isatuximab was developed, it was initially developed IV for the same reason as daratumumab was developed IV. Now, the thing is that because isatuximab was developed IV when daratumumab was already subcutaneous formulation, manual push, the company who developed the isatuximab had to come up with something new, because I'm using daratumumab. Why would I change to isatuximab? Unless isatuximab is coming into the market with something more that brought to the patients, brought to the nurse, brought to the team, a new way of doing things. Either it was only new and fancy, but useless, or it could be new, fancy, and very convenient. To be honest, I've tested a lot of subcutaneous formulations, manual push, bortezomib, that was initially IV, that became subcutaneous, then daratumumab, etc. And I never thought that someone could be genius enough to develop a subcutaneous formulation that could not be manual push and would potentially be more interesting, safer than a manual push. And that's what isatuximab pharma company had to come up with. They had no choice, because if they were coming with a manual push, they would not differentiate from daratumumab. So they worked with a small device company that developed what we call an on-body injector, on-body delivery system, which is a little box where you inject the product in the box, and the box is an automated system that sticks to your skin. The needle gets out of the box into your skin, and the product is injected smoothly, automated, very, very untidy. This device is so simple that it doesn't break, it doesn't derail. There is no problem. 97.9% of the patients in the study you alluded to earlier on actually got the product on Tylee, and in maximum 20 minutes, in a median of 12 to 13 minutes. So it's pretty quick. So the nurse now, that's when they inject daratumumab is not thick, a drug, but the hyaluronidase acid is a thick product. And the nurse now that it's difficult to push daratumumab. It's difficult to push it slowly for 5 minutes, being very patient. 5 minutes can be, it's like in basketball. If you're in soccer, 5 minutes, it's almost like 1 second. But when you play basketball, 5 minutes could last for 1 hour. And for nurses to push a daratumumab, the 5 minutes feels like 1 hour. And so what the device, I think, is genius, and not just fancy, but fancy is genius, is that the nurse has nothing to do. The device is automated. The device does it on its own. The nurse, they just give the device to the patient, show the patient the first way it works, and then they move to the next patient, they deal with the next patient, they free dealing with the next patient. They don't have to get back to the first patient that had the device on, because the device is automated. At the end of the injection, the needle gets retracted into the device, the patient can stick it out from the skin, trash it, leave, not even say bye to the nurse. I mean, it's nice to say bye to a nurse, but the patient could leave, not even letting the nurse know that the patient has left. So that's why I think this device is interesting, fancy, but potentially genius for future use. And maybe it might differentiate then isatuximab from daratumumab.
And I remember on the webinar we did, you presented a man who, first of all, that you were having patients treat themselves at home, which I thought was interesting. Yeah. And then you presented a man who I think he treated himself at work.
When you treat myeloma, you have patients 30, 40 years old, and other patients 90, 100 years old. So, of course, for the very young patient that works, to come to the hospital, wait hours to see the physician, that get the drug prescribed, that get the drugs in the department, that having the nurse giving the drug, and thereafter monitoring a little bit the patient before releasing the patients. That takes a whole day in the end, and people work. They can't necessarily waste one day in their week to do that. And so, yeah, I think this system is very convenient. Now, you could do the daratumumab at home as well. Huh? We do in France give a lot of daratumumab at home. But most of the time, you need the nurse. Yeah, but you need the nurse. Hmm. Because the injection is thick, it's difficult. So you need the nurse.
Oh, at home.
So you need to wait. Yeah, at home, it's convenient, but you have to wait for the nurse to be free and come to your house. The good thing with the device is that potentially in certain countries, the patient could go to the pharmacy, get the product, come back home, and inject himself, herself, whenever he, she wants. You don't necessarily need a nurse anymore.
You told me also you did a study where they got two different approaches, and then you asked them to compare it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the study who were used to develop the OBI isatuximab formulation was called Iraklia. But Iraklia was a registrational study. Since the drug existed before as an IV, Iraklia is a comparison of IV versus the sub-Q on-body injector system. But in the end, for the nurse, they are very happy with daratumumab. I'm pretty sure if we were proposing the nurse a new sub-Q way of giving this sub-Q formulation, but not as problematic, for example, thickness-wise, they would be happy. But so then it meant that you had to compare not IV versus sub-Q OBI formulation, but sub-Q manual push, the daratumumab way, compared to the sub-Q OBI, on-body automated system. So ISALCO is a study where patients were randomized to start for 3 months sub-Q OBI, and after 3 months, for the subsequent 3 months, so from 4 to 6 months, the subcutaneous manual push. And on the other group, patients started subcutaneous manual push, and then 3 months later, were going on subcutaneous OBI. So patients could answer the question. Number one, if you start sub-Q manual push versus OBI, which one you like better? And then the patient is its own control. because the same patient would experience the two ways, and so the same patient could experience about the two ways. So I wish I would have been smart enough to create the study, because it was really smart. It answered all the questions in terms of quality of life of the patients, and the answer was very clear, 75% versus 17%, so it's pretty great a difference, pretty obvious a difference. The better start was OBI, and the system that was seemed safest for the patients, most appreciated for the patients, in terms of I'm free, I'm doing my own stuff, it's less painful, etc. There are less local reaction, etc. was really about giving the OBI. So I think for the future, the OBI system device, I think, will probably prevail on the subcutaneous formulation manual push. It looks logical to me for the future, but we'll see.
That's going to be really interesting, because as I've been telling you, I mean, I talk to myeloma investigators, U.S. investigators, and international all the time. There are very few people that use this on-body device. They can't tell me the story you do. So I'm going to be really interested as this message starts getting out. But I think right now, even investigators, but certainly docs in practice, are not aware of what you're saying. And I think there are going to be times when nurses can bring it up to the doctor. They may not even be aware of it. So just a couple other things I want to ask you about first-line therapy. One, mentioned new trials now looking at smoldering myeloma. What is smoldering myeloma, and where do you see it heading in terms of treatment? And again, there was this big daratumumab study that was just presented. Any thoughts about that as well, anti-CD38 in smoldering?
First of all, on the patient view here, person perspective here, when you know you're diagnosed with a cancer, the feeling, if you go see the physicians and you want to get rid of the cancer, most of the patients, they want to get rid of the cancer. If you tell a patient, you know what, let's get your cancer grow, we're not going to do anything until it has grown enough. Ooh, lo, 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 lo. Most of the patients, they hate it when you say that. And that makes sense. It's like, my car is going to break, but I'm going to wait for my car to break until I go to the garage. Makes no sense. So it's in myeloma for long, we explained to the patients that it was better to wait for the cancer to grow, because the drugs we had were toxic at some point. The initial anti-cancer effect was sadly matched at some point by safety concerns. And so it was normal back then, 10, 15, 20 years ago, that the answer to the patient with smoldering myeloma that could develop a very problematic myeloma in 5 or 10 years or maybe more, that the answer to these patients were, it's better to wait. Now, today, with the incredible drugs we have, to say to a patient, you know what, it's better to wait for your myeloma to become crazy before we treat you, makes no sense anymore. So, of course, in the past 5 to 10 years, with lenalidomide first, and then daratumumab, but there are many other studies now with bispecific, with CAR, etc., with actually quadruplet transplant in Spain, we looked at, can we treat the smoldering patients, not telling them, wait for the cancer to become crazy. Now, once you've said that, you come to the next level. The next level is, okay, if I'm a patient, if you were a patient, would you like to have a treatment to wait? So you just push the time, you're going to develop your full myeloma. So you have a very light treatment that the objective is not to treat myeloma per se, but to prolong the time where you still have the myeloma smoldering, but you're not getting the big treatment. Or would you immediately get rid of your myeloma and you would better go by the big treatment now than in 10 years, knowing that in the end you'll get it? So the next level was, wait, we need to answer that question. What is better to treat smoldering? Should we treat light? The patient will get the big treatment, but maybe in 5 or 10 years. We have given them 5 or 10 years with a treatment, light, extra time before the big treatment, or we give them the big treatment right away. This is exactly where we are today. Today, we haven't yet answered your question. Plenty of studies, many studies, have studied either light treatment to delay the big treatment in the end that the patient will have to get or receive the big treatments. We have to wait for the results of all these studies. Now, we have started to get results from some of the studies. And in Spain, with a James César study, it's called James César. It's a study where you get the full bloom treatment, the big treatment right away. So we are following the patient to see how they fare, how they do. And in parallel, in other countries, we have looked at lenalidomide, lenalidomide dexamethasone, daratumumab, single agent. And we are looking at how the patient they are doing and what patient could get a kind of waiting treatment before you get the big treatment, and what patient should receive the big treatment right away, because a waiting treatment is not going to do good and is not going to get the patient a good time without needed of the big treatment. So I don't have the answer yet to your question. Studies are ongoing. And as you pointed out, the most recent study we heard about last year was the study called Aquila. And Aquila was a study of the first study with immunotherapy, daratumumab, single agent, in smoldering myeloma, to see how long it would give the patients before they get the great treatment. So the data are very important. Aquila is absolutely key. And Aquila will give the option normally to the patients to get daratumumab if they want to. But I cannot say here today to you that this is the best option for the patient. I think it's an option. And if a patient wants it, I think the patient should get it, if it's possible, country per country, depending on reimbursement, etc. But I don't want to say to the patient that it's clear, obvious to me, that to get daratumumab single agent in all myeloma smoldering is a way to treat. I don't know yet that.
So the last thing, question I want to ask you is, as you were saying, to go back to the non-transplant situation in the older patient, can you talk a little bit about how you manage those patients now?
Yeah, so it's a great point. So the thing is that what does it mean older? Older can be 72 running marathon. Older could be 92 living at home, but not running marathon anymore. And so I'm sure in the US there are 92 years old people that run marathon possibly, but not too many. So when you treat older patients, you have to be careful, because you talk about very, very different people, very different conditions, very different comorbidities, very different number of drugs and number of disease that the patient they have in parallel of being diagnosed with myeloma. Now, for what we name the fit patients, transplant ineligible, but fit. What we call the fit are patients that truly live a normal life, that probably will have a survival beyond 20 years, age-based. So you talk about patients that potentially 60, 70, because probably they would live until 90 years old. And for these patients, we kind of replicate what we knew for the transplant eligible, but knowing these patients were not transplant eligible. And the most recent data, IMROS study, CEFEU study, and our study in France Benefit demonstrated that someone 72 had no reason not to be treated exactly the same way as someone 62, but without transplant. Of course, the data in the end will not be as good. You may not get 12 to 15 years PFS, but you're probably going to get 10 years PFS, which is already really great for these patients, knowing they don't get the transplant and they don't get the issue of the transplant. So they don't get as great a PFS in the end, but they don't get the issue of the transplant. So that's point number one. And for this patient we call fit, it's very easy. You replicate the transplant eligible path without the transplant. For the patients that are not as fit, we still don't know what we know what treatment we give, but we don't know whether we already found out the best treatment to give to these patients. I think we're going to still make progress for the patients that are not as fit as the other. For these patients, we are very careful, because the patients that are what we call frail or frailer,
these patients are more likely to suffer from side effects. So there's no point in giving 10 years survival to a patient and that patient suffering a lot from side effects. The patient, they don't like it. I have many patients, the first thing they ask is no side effect and then survival. And I have many patients, they had so many side effects that they tell me, I wish I would have died. And I'm like, I'm totally distressed when I hear that because I feel like I don't do my job right. So the for the frailer patients, we're still looking into best treatment. But of course, the CD30 antibody did a great job and it was tremendously safe and active for these patients. So it has become the obvious standard of care for these patients. But one thing that all of the myeloma patients, but the frailer patients, transplant ineligible on top, they are asking for is what we discussed earlier, you and I, which is how to fix the duration of my treatment, 1 year, 2 years only, and then I would have a treatment-free interval and the same PFS in the end. That we don't know, but of course, the lighter you give a treatment to a patient, the less likely you can offer a treatment-free interval. And that's probably why the frailer were more in difficulties with these patients.
Yeah, and maybe immunotherapy, CAR T, bispecifics will allow at some point people to go off therapy. So yeah, I was just thinking about the ringing the bell thing, and you were talking about these older patients, and I was remembering that in breast cancer, there used to be an online tool called Adjuvant Online. It was developed by Dr. Peter Ravdin, and you would put in all these numbers about breast cancer, their tumor size, and then you put in their age. And they would give you the impact of adjuvant therapy and the impact on survival. But the thing that was interesting was that they also factored in non-competing causes of death. So mm-hmm. when you started to get at 75, 80, 85, non-competing causes of death came to be more than the risk of breast cancer. And getting back to myeloma, you have an 80-year-old patient and people 80 years old have, you know, they have a pretty good survival, but still a significant cause of non-cancer death that has to be considered.
But not too much, Neil. You're right. But the difference with breast cancer is that breast cancer get cured. So, you know, after 6 months or 1 year, so I'm not breast physician, so apologize. But you know you're going to have issues for 6 months, a year. But if you get cured, you know you off treatment, off issues anymore for the rest of your life, whatever it is, 82 plus. In myeloma, the problem is that the more you go, the more you get closer to your relapse. So the more you go on treatment, the more you get closer to the next treatment and your relapse. And that's why for frail patients, it's even more difficult with myeloma than with breast cancer, I believe.
You know, I would say, too, that a lot of these, unfortunately, a lot of the people who ring the bell will later develop a recurrence, metastatic disease, and die from the disease.
Yeah, so maybe,
even though they've completed adjuvant therapy, it's just a different model. But in the end, if you can avoid dying of a disease and suffering from it, that's our objective in general.
Agree to that, absolutely.
This concludes part one of our program. Be sure to check out part two with nurse practitioner Ms. Charisse Gleason. Special thanks to Dr. Leloup, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Nursing Update.